All right. Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. Together with my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technology that you, my fellow millennials, should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by Alexander Svetsky. He's an author and entrepreneur who ran numerous ventures in the past 15 years. And together with Mark Moss, he wrote and published the best-selling book On a Communist Manifesto and is now working on a next book called The Bushido of Bitcoin. He also founded the Bitcoin Times in 2018, a limited once-a-year published magazine covering Bitcoin's current affairs. And he's currently building multiple open-source AI tools with a focus on the spirit of Satoshi, the world's first Bitcoin-centric language model. Well, that's a lot of stuff, man. Welcome.
Thanks, man. Yes, I have a disease, which is I can't sit straight. I can't sit in one spot. Too many things.
Isn't that also what Bitcoin makes you do a bit? Like you want to contribute to it?
Yeah, you want to. I mean, Bitcoin, yes, it does. It absolutely does incentivize wanting to do bigger things with your life. And I think that's something we'll discuss in today's episode, but something moderns have lost. You know, we've sort of been, you know, psyoped into valuing average instead of excellence. And, you know, everyone's, you know, taught that it's okay, you know, just to be just average and do just enough, right? And I think I find that a disgusting way to live.
I really like the memes, but it's sad at the same time, like these memes of, it's a specific name for like carving of statues where the statues have like a veil, right? Or they're wearing something on their head. Do you know what I mean? Like it's this old like Greek, it's like a certain way of creating sculptures as if someone is wearing something over their head, like a cloth or something. Do you know this style?
No, I don't know it. No,
I'll send you a picture. But like people send these memes like, why don't we do this anymore? Like it's just like this crazy amount of time that people spend on a statue, right? That just lives for a few thousand years, and we are still marveling at like how did they do that? I think that is to your point, right? That we don't really know how to do that anymore, or also not really incentivized to take, I don't know, a year or two just creating a sculpture. So yeah,
totally. Beauty takes time, and we don't want to invest time in anything anymore.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll dive into that. But first, I wanted to ask you, how did you discover Bitcoin, and what made you not get it initially?
Ooh, I was a gold bug back in between 2008 and 2012. I was a crazy gold bug, right? I was into gold, silver. I was buying that stuff. I was watching Max Keyser, Doug Casey, all these crazy people, Mike Maloney, etc., talking about gold and silver, because I had taken my scholarship money. I was studying civil engineering. I took my scholarship money. I put it on the stock market, and I lost everything basically. And I spent all this time trying to figure out how was I so stupid. And that's where I sort of found gold, sound money as a concept. And it was around that time that I first heard about Bitcoin, I believe. I remember where or how. Maybe it was Max Keyser jumping up and down on the couch or something, yelling about Bitcoin. But
I can remember that also. Yeah,
it was something. But I honestly, I never took it seriously. I was like, yeah, whatever, sound money, right? I've got my gold, I got my silver. That's all I was interested in. So my life took me a different direction. I was on an entrepreneurial path. I was building businesses. I got into tech. I was, building startups, all sorts of things like that. And it wasn't until 2015 again that late 2015, early 2016, that a friend of mine said, hey, bro, you heard of this Bitcoin thing? And I was like, yeah, I heard about that a while ago. Like, is it still around? And he's like, yeah, bro, my friend made, $1 million overnight from it. But I was like, fuck, this guy talking about? And we get into this conversation. I look up Bitcoin and I see it's something like $500 or whatever it was at the time. And I was like, holy crap. Like I remember this being at like dollars or something, like, something of those sort of that range. And, that obviously interested me in it. And I started going down the rabbit hole, and I've got this sort of meme that I say to people is like, I came for the money, but I stayed for the money. So like when you start to understand like what the money actually entails, there's a bigger thing at play here, right? And And yeah, that, like, as I started going down that rabbit hole, it was particularly, you know, 2017 where I really became a Bitcoin maximalist. You know, I realized there was something special, something important, something unique here. And here I am today, writing, building businesses, doing all sorts of stuff in and around Bitcoin.
Nice, man. Yeah, it's interesting that number go up, obviously, is for a lot of people the thing where they get into Bitcoin. But then when you realize that it's actually so much bigger, could be so much bigger, but already so much bigger than just you as the individual, right? It's so fascinating also to, I don't know how you experience that, but for me, like, sometimes I end up somewhere in just my rational thinking. And then I think, like, no, it cannot be that big, right? And then I watch other people talk about their own journey, and then they end up in the same place. And then I think, like, okay, well, maybe there's some merit to it still, right? So you do need to see that other people, you know, who you respect or you enjoy their thinking, that they end up in the same place, just to keep your own, well, almost ego in check, right? In a good way.
There's either definitely something here, or we are the most ridiculously stupid group of cultists in the history of humanity. It's literally one of the two. Like, one of the two extremes. There's no middle ground here.
Yeah. 100% agree. I once someone told me, yeah, the CIA made it and this and that and blah, blah. I said, well, if the CIA made this and this comes out and it's all bad and all doom and gloom and whatever, then I think I have to live in a cave and, like, I don't know, like, go away. Like, I would be honestly, like, I would have fooled myself. So I fully agree, man. Like, it's zero or everything, right? Yeah, let's talk about the stuff you did, man. I love the name Uncommunist Manifesto.
Thank you.
It's a book with Mark Moss where you argue for a society structured around natural capitalist principles, dynamic inequality. I would love to hear what you mean by that. Mm-hmm. And social mobility based on individual merit and competence. That's something I really like. You know, that's you know, equality of opportunity, not outcome, right? What inspired you to write this?
Yeah, so the book came about as a joke initially. So Mark and I were in Salvador, kind of between the Salvador Bitcoin announcement and the implementation. So I think it was like July 2021 or something like that. And he just asked me, we were having lunch, and he said, have you read the Communist Manifesto? And I was like, why the fuck would I do that? And he's like, it's really bad. And I said, I'm sure it is, Mark. I said, why would I want to give myself brain cancer by reading this? And he's like, you know, he goes, did you realize it was like the one of the most widely read socio or sort of political economics books in history? And I was like, damn, bro. I was like, that explains why the world is so dumb. And, you know, he sort of just said as a passing comment, you know, someone should write a rebuttal to this, or, you know, something similar to this that offers a different perspective. And, you know, I said to him, I was like, you know, maybe we should do it one day. And we kind of left it at that. And it was 6-7 months later in Austin, like, some things had changed in my life and I had a bit of time up my sleeve. And I hit him up. I said, hey, dude, let's write this book. You know, let's lock ourselves in a room in an Airbnb and let's sit down and do a book sprint. And we wrote the bulk of the book in a week. And we, you know, coming into it, I wasn't sure exactly what we're going to write. You know, like, we started off kind of doing like a rebuttal, you know, chapter by chapter, point by point. But then kind of the book took on its own life. So the only thing that emulates from the original Communist Manifesto is like the 4-chapter structure. But other than that, like, it's its own manifesto. It lives on its own. And the name also came about as a joke because we weren't sure what to name it. We were going to call it the Capitalist Manifesto, the Libertarian Manifesto, the Individualist Manifesto, the Sovereign. Like, we were throwing out these names. We're like, man, they all be like, they suck. So, you know, we were sitting there with Mark's wife, and she kind of, it was just really funny. She goes, why don't you call it the Uncommunist Manifesto? And we kind of like looked at each other. We're like, damn, that's pretty good. So we
had to uncommunist yourself, basically.
It was great. And we were like, okay, let's just roll with that. And yeah, the book sort of, I'm actually very proud of it. Like, it's a very easy read. It takes, you know, you could go sit there and spend years reading Rothbard, Mises, you know, Austrian economics, libertarian philosophy, like all this sort of stuff. Or you could, in an hour and a half, read the Uncommunist Manifesto and get basically a really well written. And I'm not just saying well written to blow smoke up my own ass, but I think Mark and I really did a good job of taking these complex ideas and making them simple and kind of extracting four or five like key ideas that people can walk away with that can adjust their frame of reference, the way they view the world. And yeah. And I'm actually in the process of trying to get the book into Malay's hands for his cabinet, because like he's going to have a big job of trying to re-educate the Argentine public on these principles, these ideas. And something like this, like nobody's going to sit down and read a Rothbard textbook, you know, or maybe a few people will, but not a mass amount of people. But people will read 90 minutes of a book. And, you know, this could fundamentally shift the way people think. So hopefully it becomes that kind of thing. And yeah, that's basically the premise of the book. We can dig into some of those points.
Yeah,
you mentioned.
Awesome. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the concept of dynamic inequality and why it's so important in the manifesto.
Yeah, so I mean, I think equality is a scam. Equality of all kinds is a scam. And we'll talk about this next, which is I think it's not only equality of outcome, which is bad, but equality of opportunity is also stupid. So, you know, what for me fundamentally is important is inequality. Now, when I say inequality, I mean variance. I mean, I mean diverse outcomes. I mean hierarchy. I mean excellence. You know, so all of these things which fundamentally, I mean life, right? Like, show me something in life that is equal. Nothing. Like, you know, you look out.
Agree.
You know, I'm looking out at the ocean now. The ocean is not flat and equal. Like, there's, you know, waves up and down. Like, I'm looking at the mountains. Like, you know, we as human beings, we are different. You know, like, we look different. Now, you know, even in a game, if you have a fair game, like a basketball game, if the rules are fair, the outcomes are going to be unequal. That's what you want. You know, you want a winner and a loser, right? So life, anything that is living, anything that is alive, seeks inequality. That which is dead, for example, or death-oriented, seeks equality. Like, equality is a state of flatness and of death, right? Like, you know, another good analogy to think about is...
That's no growth.
Well, exactly. And no growth literally means death. There's no, like... So this is what this is a Tony Robbins thing that I learned many years ago. He said, like, you do not get to pick between... growth and no growth. You actually have to pick between growth and death. Living things are either growing or they're dying. There's no like stasis point, right? So the example I was going to use was you look at colors, right? Like red, blue, green, blah, blah, blah. Like all these different colors are unequal. They're different. If you take all the colors and want to make them equal, you mash them all together and what do you get? Gray, right? Like so gray color of communism, right? Gray is the color of death. Like flatlining is the color of death. So you know, what you need in a functional, alive society is inequality, but it needs to be dynamic. So, like, you can't have static inequality, meaning, all right, I'm a central banker, I can print all the money I want, and you, middle class, whatever, producer, consumer, whatever, doesn't matter, you get robbed, and we create this static inequality where you end up with a smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller percentage of people who have everything and a larger and larger and larger percentage of people who have nothing, right? And that's a recipe for the breaking of a functional system, whereas dynamic inequality creates a robust functional system. And nature is full of dynamic inequality. All of nature is like that. Humanity, I shouldn't say humanity, I should say the modern version of the, you know, the kind of collectivism that we've tried to create is an attempt at creating is an attempt at trying to create equality and ending up with static inequality because of how stupid that attempt is.
Yeah, it's like I had to think of the word nature too. In general, it's fascinating. I like the quote, have you ever see a tree stop growing? You know, it's the same thing. Like, it's there's no tree that wakes up you know, with the sun and things. Today I'm not going to do anything, right? But yeah, so and where that tree seed fell, you know, on the side of a rock or a nice plain with water and you know, all the nutrients and whatever, like that's the chaos of life, right? So when you just shared this, I also have to think of nature, but isn't the problem more, and I like what you said, like it's the modern human thinking where we can like exclude ourselves from nature because... Mm-hmm. We can think or, you know, construct some rationale as to why we are outside of nature, right? Isn't it something like that as well? That yeah, it's kind of hubris in a sense.
Yeah. I write about this a lot in the upcoming book, The Bushido of Bitcoin. I talk about what I call physiopsychology. And you know, this is a bit of a Nietzschean idea in some senses, that we've tried to separate the mind from the body, right? And the body is the thing that connects us to nature, right? You know, the body is this biological thing. And to a degree, the mind is either a extension of the body, you know, or something. But, you know, the mind is also natural, but it has this tendency to create this separation from, mm-hmm. you know, nature, the body. And, you know, it's even in our language, you know, mind over matter, right? It's like, no, it's mind and matter together, right? Like these things are fundamentally inextricably linked. And yeah, it's just, you're spot on when you say like we've created the separation, then we wonder why we are no longer connected to, you know, reality.
Yeah.
You know, that's the consequence.
And so you also talk in a book about individual autonomy, like how does that help people or society shape different economic structures? Like, why is that? Because a lot of people are dependent right now.
Yeah. So this one, I mean, you know, I've come to believe that some people just are fundamentally incapable of autonomy. You know, like if 2020 taught me anything, is like some people are literally living, breathing NPCs. You know, they can't think for themselves, and like they're just zombies, right? But you know, Generally speaking, humans are adaptable, and we either adapt to being independent or being dependent, one of the two, right? And like a great way to think about it is our smartphones, right? I remember when I was young, before the smartphone, I was doing door-to-door sales. I was knocking on doors, and this was before we had Google Maps. Like, such a thing didn't exist. We would get given, like, we had those big street maps, like the big fat mm-hmm. books. And before going out, what we called on the field, before we'd go out and knock on doors, we'd take the street map, photocopy, and then we'd mark out what our territory was and pass it around to each salesperson. And you would like learn the territory somehow, like bodily wise. Like I could get dropped in any suburb, anywhere, and I just knew my way around. I didn't need a map. I didn't need Google Maps. I didn't need shit. These days, you drop somebody in like the middle of a capital city with signs everywhere, they'll be lost in 5 minutes without Google Maps, without their phone. They'll freak the fuck out. They'll have anxiety. So it's like we adapt to, yeah, as I said, dependence or independence. And, you know, more broadly speaking, we adapt to freedom or slavery. Now, each one comes with a cost, right? Freedom and independence is messy. Like it's, you know, it's not clean. It's not like, it's not sterile, right? It's not a, you know, you can't control everything, but it is a environment for growth, right? Like the jungle where the things grow the best is the least controlled environment, right? Whereas, you know, if you want to control and sterilize everything, sterile by definition means dead. You know, you have a environment of dependence, like everything is controlled, and those environments are not conducive to life. So we have to pick a direction. And that direction really matters, you know, in the same way as, you know, if you're looking west, if you're facing west and looking for a sunrise, it's just not going to happen, right? Like it's fundamentally impossible. So like if you want a society that grows, you have to face in the direction of growth, autonomy, independence, freedom, etc.
Yeah. It's nice. I what I like is that also about Bitcoin, to link it to Bitcoin, like, I think Bitcoin really shows you that. It shows you that there's an opportunity to act different in your life, maybe take that responsibility, right, and be more sovereign. And the fact that it actually, you even become aware of it, right? Because I think personally, like, I was very unaware, right? In general, I say, you know, if you grow up as a millennial in a Western country, then you're probably pretty unaware of how, you know, how else you could live your life, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's really about, you know, short-term preference, or kind of like the easy choices, hard life, hard choices, easy life, right? Because what you say about the freedom, that means you have to fight in a sense. And if you want to be complacent, you don't have to fight, but then like all your self-sovereignty, like everything is gone, right? So there's kind of this do you take the easy path or do you take the hard path? But I think in Western societies in general, you're not even forced to think about that. You know, if you, I thought about that actually in the COVID times. You know, here it was pretty okay, but I saw pictures from India, for example, where people who worked in cities had to go back to the rural areas that they came from, right? And there was like 50,000 people or 100,000 people at a train station waiting. And I read all these crazy stories about, you know, siblings with their dead mother on a motorbike for 300 kilometers. I was like, damn, you know, like this exists currently in the world. Like these people have to think about these things every day, right? Because if you don't, if you are complacent, you know, that could be the end of your life in essence, right? And in a Western country, you could stay in bed all day and nothing happens basically, right? So you're not forced to think about it.
You adapt to your environment. Yeah. That's what humans are. We're adaptation machines.
And so how can you get to a point where you see that other option? Is that only when you have a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has to be a catalyst. And, you know, each of us, I mean, life's not smooth for anybody, right? We've all got some sort of challenge, some sort of problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some way, shape, or form, life is going to throw you a curveball. It's going to challenge you. And it's what you do. It's you know, it's a classic personal development kind of thing, right? It's not what happens to you. It's what you do with it that matters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can be a victim or a victor, and you can take ownership, take responsibility once again of the situation, and you know, then do something with it. So, you know, fundamentally speaking, like we live in a world absent responsibility. I wrote an article a couple of years ago called "Responsibility Go Up Technology." Right, so everyone talks about NGU. And I said, well, look, you know, that's cool and all. It's important, gets people in. But, you know, you come for the NGU, you stay for the RGU, the responsibility go up. And, you know, I kind of framed Bitcoin as, you know, it's most important thing is it's not freedom money, which, I mean, it is freedom money, but that's not as important. What's more important is that it's responsibility money or responsible money. And, you know, I've said this many times, is Bitcoin's most important impact on civilization is not that it's going to help the weak and bank the unbanked. No. It's going to re-localize economic consequence. That is more important than anything else. And not even just a little bit more important. Like I'm talking fucking orders of magnitude. It's the 99% of Bitcoin's importance is the relocalization of economic consequence. Every other benefit is the 1%. Doesn't fucking matter. Like in
you mean
in
the distributing it across the layers again. So
yeah, I mean,
from the bottom layer back up.
What do you mean by that?
As in the you said economic?
Localizing economic consequence.
Yeah, exactly. So do you mean that in a geographical way? I was thinking more about the consequence of the four cantillionaires to abuse, you know, how money is not there on that on that level. That's kind of
where I mean,
I went.
Okay. Yeah. What I mean specifically is localizing economic consequence, meaning that when an individual makes a decision inside an economy, so an economy is just made up of a bunch of actors, mm-hmm. agents acting, their actions have an economic consequence, and that economic consequence should be paid by the actor, not by other actors. So gotcha. That's essentially what I mean. So the world we live in at the moment has zero localization of economic consequence. Someone can go and print money, and the consequence is distributed amongst everybody. So in other words, like if I'm a central banker, I can play the game of I'll jump off a cliff and instead of me dying, Bram dies.
Yeah.
And I jump off a cliff again and then somebody else dies.
Yeah.
So what does that teach me? I can jump off as many cliffs as I want and somebody else fucking dies. So somebody else is always paying the bill. Bitcoin will ensure that that consequence localizes. Now, it's not going to be perfect because it's impossible to get perfection, but the more that localizes, the more you get two effects. You get positive reinforcement for good behavior, and you get negative reinforcement for bad behavior. That simultaneously creates a corrective mechanism in society, in civilization, so that the good is kept and the bad is either corrected or removed. That is so important for a functional system. And that's what Bitcoin does to the world. Like if you, like, I'll give you an analogy. If you lost the pain receptors in your hand, you could put your hand in the fire and you could literally burn off your hand and you wouldn't even fucking know. And that's the world that we're living in at the moment. We are eroding our capital base. We're eroding out the civilization that we have. And we don't even know because we just keep printing money and we cover up the losses.
Yeah.
And that's what Bitcoin does. It makes losses real again. And that's so important.
I find it so fascinating that it's not like that, right? I mean, it sounds so simple. And at the same time, I think, like, why is it not like that, right? But it is maybe also because of the human nature that we kind of just touched upon, right? Like, if I don't have to think about it, then, why would I question it, right? And especially if it just works for me and I still don't have to think about it, right? I mean, yeah, so it makes sense. When or how do we achieve a more, like, more of something that's really a meritocracy then?
I mean, like, Bitcoin plays a big factor in that, right? So, like, you know, we can have a social revolution, right? We can have a political revolution. We can do all these sorts of stuff. And, you know, this has happened many, many times throughout history, right? We've had the debauchery of the currency, and, you know, that goes hand in hand. Like, you know, people say the root of all of the problems is the money printing. And I disagree with that. I think the root of all the problems starts culturally upstream. That's where the cancer starts. And honestly, it's the introduction of concepts such as equality and democracy, right? As soon as we start to make things average, we move our gaze from ascendance and excellence to average, and average is the first step towards death. This is Breedlove and I were discussing this. So that directionality is really important. Now, that leads us to inevitably printing money, and then printing money just accelerates the destabilization and the debasement of civilization, right? So what ends up happening is civilization falls apart. We have a revolution. We restart things. We're like, okay, no, we've got to do things better. We've got to do things different. And here we go again, right? And we enter a new cycle. Now, Bitcoin specifically might, you know, save us from having to repeat these cycles over and over again, because it makes it so that acceleration point never happens. And we are in a position where it makes, like, there is a better reward for better behavior and there is a consequence for poor behavior. And once you establish that or create that in a society, you have some corrective mechanisms. So, you know, Bitcoin fundamentally is like a really key important part. But add to that, and this is what my book is about, you know, the Bushido of Bitcoin is, what are the virtues, what are the principles that we must embody, that we must inculcate in ourselves first, it's very important, so that it becomes a part of our culture, so that we have a strong culture that actually excels on a Bitcoin standard. So the way you can sort of think about the Bushido is like, okay, we have a rule book in the current world. The rule book today is get into banking, get into fucking tech, VC, like figure out a way to get into politics, central banking, whatever. Find a way to lie, cheat, steal, be cunning, whatever, right? Now, not everybody does that, but a large amount of people do that. Or it tells you, you know, the rule book is be a fucking consumer, just buy shit, you know, or, you know, invest, right? Like, so we you know, the modern playbook is a playbook of stupidity, right? The Bitcoin playbook, you know, to get ahead on a Bitcoin standard, I believe you're going to need to have principles like justice, like courage, like loyalty, respect, excellence, responsibility, compassion. Like, so the whole point of the book is, I said, okay, what are the principles and virtues we need to establish and develop in ourselves as individuals? So that, I believe, is, you know, the sort of the two-pronged approach is Bitcoin fundamentally fix the economics and you fix the framework for the world, but then it's within that framework, how do you excel? And that is by establishing a culture of made up of individuals who have a strong set of virtues. And then the question is, what are those virtues? And that was the exact point of the damn book, is let's identify what these are. Let's look at where they were successful throughout history and what we can do to bring them forward you know, onto a Bitcoin standard.
Yeah. So that's really how we apply. I kind of see it like this, where if Bitcoin is the base layer of truth, right? In that sense, I see Bitcoin as like engineered truth. If that's always just the truth on which we build, then you are basically talking about how we apply Bitcoin as a tool, or how we use Bitcoin as a tool to build that Bitcoin-enabled new society, basically. Like, how do we apply the tool of Bitcoin, right? Because Bitcoin does force us, in a sense, mm-hmm. to implement this kind of reward and punishment system, as you said, right? You can only profit, quote-unquote, from Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin can only give you value when you follow the base set of rules that everyone can see, right? And if you try to mess with the rules, then you won't get anything out of it, basically, right? So that incentive is already built in, but you talk about, okay, how do we actually integrate that and then build together?
Yes, to a degree. If I was to rephrase it, I would say, like, you're 100% on the right track. There's these principles that make Bitcoin special, and then how do we take those principles and use Bitcoin to then establish a better society?
Yeah,
I would say we will succeed when we've forgotten all about Bitcoin. So when Bitcoin kind of dissolves into the background and nobody like you and me are not writing Bitcoin books anymore, not doing podcasts, nobody gives a fuck, because, you know, like, do you see people today doing a podcast on the internet? No, like, it's just the internet, right? Like, we all use it. So when we stop talking about Bitcoin, that's when we know it will have succeeded, because it becomes this framework. And then it's less about using Bitcoin. It's more about, as I said, cultural principles that operate best on the framework that Bitcoin establishes, the socioeconomic framework.
Would you define that as some sort of age of enlightenment, in a sense, then?
Yeah, you could call it that. You know, I think it's definitely a new age. I mean, this is where we can tie it to some of the stuff that I've written about Nietzsche, right? So Nietzsche, you know, 150 years ago predicted, he said, you know, and he did this at a time when the Western civilization was at its peak. Like, you know, you had Germany, like, you know, Wagner, like, you know, Europe was winning big time, right? Like, it was the peak of civilization. He said, you know, while you idiots are all partying, I am telling you that civilization is going to fall apart. And people are like, you're fucking crazy. What are you talking about? And his whole point was, we are letting in these ideas of equalitarianism, of average, of, you know, democratic thinking. We are shifting our gaze from excellence. And what's going to happen? And he said, it's going to take many, many generations. It's going to take 100, 200 years. But we're going to enter the age of what he called the last man. And, you know, millennials, you know, today we might understand this last man concept as the NPC or the lemming, right, or the masses. And he said, you know, we're going to enter this age of this cynical person who wants to just tear down everything that's beautiful and turn it all into rubble. But he said also, from that age, from that time, a new archetype of person will rise. And he called it the Übermensch, you know, the overman. And, you know, I write about this in my latest piece on the Bitcoin Times. I call it Uber money. And I say that, you know, what Nietzsche was essentially missing was this framework of excellence, which is a praxeological framework, which is a monetary network, which is Bitcoin, establishes a framework for that kind of an age to rise up. But that age will only rise up from an age of complete shamelessness and debauchery and stupidity. So we're kind of at that point. Now, I don't know how bad clown world is going to get. It's probably going to get worse before it gets better.
Even worse.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's going to get worse. But from that will rise what you're kind of thinking of, this age of enlightenment, or the age of, you know, the early stages of the Übermensch, the age of the Übermensch.
So the Übermensch needs this Uber money. I also saw you talk about Bitcoin as energy money, but it's kind of you combine these Nietzsche ideas and Bitcoin. Can you share a bit about that? Like, how do you end up with Uber money or energy money?
So, I mean, energy money, if anyone's ever listened to your stuff, Sailor stuff, whatever, they'll sort of understand, right? But Bitcoin is conservatively sound, right? You can't print more of it. You can't create more of it. It's, you know, it's fixed in supply, blah, 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 which what it mimics is essentially energy. You can't create energy. You can't destroy it. All you can do is transform it and, you know, transmit it, right? You can harvest it, harness it, but you're not creating anything. So Bitcoin kind of shares that relationship. And, you know, physicists call energy, the currency of the universe, because in many ways, everything is made up of that. So, you know, Bitcoin is a currency, right? Like that's what it does. And it, you know, allows you to transmit time and energy over space and all this sort of stuff that, you know, we've heard Saylor talk about millions of times. The point here is that, you know, it's not to say, literally speaking, that Bitcoin is energy money, but metaphorically, that is a powerful metaphor and it yeah. works. So I then relate that to this idea of Uber money, which is, okay, if you have an energetically or conservative money, something that you can't corrupt, then you have that framework. Like I said this on a recent podcast, I said, if reality could be defined as that which is irreversible, then Bitcoin is the realest money we've ever had, because Bitcoin is yeah. irreversible, right? And that kind of a framework establishes a need for excellence. And excellence is the pathway to the Ubermensch, like excellence over generations. You have to breed the Ubermensch.
It like, gives you an anchor. It gives you an anchor point in the future, right? Like that's what I meant with engineered truth. I think we say the same, right? It's irreversible. So it just is, in a sense, like time is, right? And we can prove that it is because, you know, we have all the validators and all the code. It's like it's so transparent that you can prove that it just is. Hmm. And yeah, once you accept that, then you can set an anchor point in the future because you know that what you are operating on is truth, in a sense. And so you can head towards that direction. Does that make sense? Like that's kind of how I created in my mind there.
Yeah, you can use it as a magnet or a catalyst. Either way, right? So so a catalyst pushes it or a magnet attracts. You know, and it's you know it's some mix of both.
Yeah, and so you talk about these ideas in this new edition of the Bitcoin Times. I think I said it correctly. It's a limited once a year.
Yeah,
magazine,
you nailed it.
Right?
Yeah, you nailed it.
It's
yes.
the sixth edition.
Yes.
Why do you focus on energy now? What's the yeah the relationship between Bitcoin and energy? I think you just mentioned it. Why now about energy?
Yeah. So I mean, each year is a different theme, right? So the year before we did the Austrian edition. You know, the one before that was kind of like a futuristic edition called A New Hope. The one before that was the Promethean edition. The one before that was the Sovereignty edition. So like each one has a theme. And last year there was just this growing noise around like energy, FUD, climate catastrophists, the world's going to fucking end. We're going to boil the oceans. You know, everything's going to die. Like, you know, we're boiling in Europe at 36 degrees. I was like, bro, I grew up in Australia, like normal summer day was 45. None of us boiled. Okay.
Well, and when I was younger, 36 degrees or 32 was like a yellow on the map. And now
yeah.
it was like a super dark red, which
yeah,
is
exactly.
fascinating
We're all gonna
to
die.
See. Yeah.
So, you know, I just got sick of all that garbage and I was like, man, you know, let's do the energy edition. Let's write about this. And there's six obviously fantastic writers in there. Parker Lewis did the foreword. Andrew Myers, who's doing incredible work with a company called Satoshi Energy. He's like linking up large scale energy producers with the Lightning Network and enabling them to price their energy in real time in sats. There's Gideon Powell, who's comes from a oil and gas background. His dad was one of the early wildcatters out of Texas. So he writes this incredible piece on human ingenuity. And like he quotes this guy called Julian Simon, who has a fascinating economic take, which he says, there's no such thing as finite resources. So the only thing that's finite is human ingenuity. So like we're not running out of molecules. We're not running out of atoms. Like, you know, there's an infinite amount of those. What we're running out of is ideas and capacity to be ingenious, right? So like that's the only limiting factor. We're never going to run out of oil molecules. They're all there. Carbon atoms are all there. So it's our capacity to extract that. So he does a piece, Brian Gitt, he's kind of like of the Alex Epstein sort of crowd. He did a fantastic piece on nuclear and how that can solve a bunch of problems for modern computing. There was Drew Armstrong, who did a really deep piece, like if people like stuff from like Gigi and, you know, really deep thinking about physics and like the nature of existence. Cool. He did one called On Entropy. And then, yeah, I did a piece that kind of explores this relationship between energy, Bitcoin, excellence, and Nietzsche's ideas. And, you know, it's quite philosophical, you know, it'll get people fired up, but yeah, it's a different, different angle. So we do this once a year. These essays are purely published for the Bitcoin Times. People can buy it as a collectible if they want. They can read the essays online for free on our Substack. And this year I'm also going to launch a Amazon paperback edition. So that way it's cheap. Like, cause the collectible, fun. The collectible is expensive. Like it's about $100 a pop, $100 a copy, but it's like, it's priced in sets and there's only 2,100 printed and they've got a code on the back. So like, I actually, for people listening, I'll show them one. So I obviously have number one of 2,100.
Nice.
So, and cool. You know, the set, so that's, this is edition, so that's three, this is four, so that's one of 2,100. Fun. So yeah, people can pick that up or, you know, the Amazon edition when it comes out. But yeah, the idea is like timeless, beautiful content that will inspire people, make them think, and give them what they need to understand about Bitcoin.
Yeah. I think you just touched upon it. The subject of abundance of energy and why it's so important. Is that what you mentioned with regards to, yeah, we have all these building blocks in essence. There's no finite supply. Now that we're talking about something like is just the idea of there's finite resources and thus it's all going very bad. Isn't that just like a prime example of like the downward thinking that you
it really is.
That you mentioned exactly. Before, right? Yeah. It's like, oh my God, I cannot do anything. Someone else has to do something, or the earth has to change whatever it's doing, and then I'm saved, right? Yeah. This is kind of the apathy.
Yeah, it's the victim, and apathy is a great word. Like it is the apathetic victim mindset that is like, you know, that is the cancer that is destroying the world. Like the cancer of the world is not fucking climate change. The cancer of the world is, you know, this brain dead idea that we are powerless to do anything about it. Not the case.
Again, could stem from the fact that if we place ourselves outside of nature, then obviously we would end up at this place.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we do need to understand, like, there's a link to nature, but we are, I think, in many ways, the apex manifestation of nature. So we need to remember that, too. So there's some people who are like, oh, you know, nature is everything and, you know, like, humans are insignificant, right? No, we are significant. We are definitely like, we are both a part of nature, but like, if you think about it like this, it's like life, you know, so you've got energy, then life is kind of the, you know, the hand reaching out. And you know, human beings are like the fingertips. Like we are the very, we are the very tip of life. We are the highest, most complex, most, you know, sophisticated manifestation of life, which itself is the highest, most ordered, sophisticated manifestation of energy. And, you know, energy is the thing, it's the substance, right? That animates everything. So like we need to recognize that and, you know, we need to live with that. So that doesn't mean we disconnect ourselves from nature. We are a part of it, but we need to understand that we are creators. We build, we produce, we create. And, I mean, if you take a loser's mentality, don't be surprised that you fucking lose, right? Like, so you need to.
I agree. Yeah.
1 + 1 = 2. You know.
Yeah. And you just mentioned like the ingenuity. How does human ingenuity play in the context of Bitcoin and energy? I mean, there's so many examples already of people, you know, capturing methane and optimizing grids and all these things. Like, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. Like, you know, like just the things that human beings can come up with, like both stupid and intelligent, is like beyond you know, you'll never be able to put a cap on it, right? Like, that's human ingenuity. We come up with things. AI can never do that. Like, we are fundamentally creators, creative, and the things we'll come up with, the gaps we'll close, are fascinating. And as you said, like, down to things like, okay, we flare gas, so let's put a Bitcoin. I mean, actually, one interesting one that I saw a little while ago was this spa in New York. They, you know, they have heated pools. So what they've done is they've got these, you know, miners that are immersed in liquid, and that liquid heats the water, and then, you know, they run the spa. The heated pools and the heated water in the spa comes from the miners. Brilliant. Absolutely fucking brilliant. Like, yeah. I looked at that, I was like, damn, I want to do that. I literally want to build that in my own house so that I have a hot tub and it's powered by miners. Like, brilliant.
Most of all, it's just really cool. But yeah, it's it's funny how stupid and brilliant is. Have you ever read the Kybalion? You know that? Like, about the hermetic principles? Like, as above, so below. As below, so above. Like it's about these universal principles. But they say, like there's a law of polarity as well. And it's okay. Like brilliance and stupidity is not, it's the same thing. It's just a different intensity of the same thing, right? Yeah, like hot and cold, or light and dark, right? And well, sometimes also really stupid and simple ideas actually are pretty brilliant, right?
Yeah, totally. It's like excitement, anxiety, right? They're shades of each other, right?
Exactly. That's a better word. And so, do you also talk about like the environmental concerns, or at least what people talk about about Bitcoin?
Yeah, Marty Bent did a whole piece on that. I forgot to mention him, actually. So he did a piece on that where he basically debunks the whole ESG narrative and all that sort of stuff. It's fantastic. And he uses Germany as a great example of, you know, of a country who on paper has increased their energy capacity, you know, with all of the renewable energy crap that they're doing. But in reality, they actually haven't they've, I think their on paper energy capacity is double or triple what it used to be like 20 years ago. But the real difference in energy use is only up 2%, which means like that's the maximum they can actually use out of it. So it's like it just shows like the lie. And his whole essay is built around this idea of it's time to come back to reality. Like, we've just been lying to ourselves. And if we continue lying to ourselves, something's going to break and it's going to be catastrophic.
Yeah. And so, if we talk about the Uncommunist Manifesto and Bitcoin, and we talked about meritocracy, I also wanted to ask you, if there's an ideal society and there is a meritocracy and we have this dynamic inequality, is then capitalism the system? Or like, how do you view that? Is that the most fair type of system then you could use, or is there something else?
Pretty much. Like, I think you can... So in the book, we boil down capitalism to not a political modality, but a natural process, right? So if you define what capital is things and stuff, right? So there's kind of three forms of primary capital, you can call it: time, energy, natural resources, right? And, you know, what we do as human beings, as a living species, is we take these building blocks and we try to use them as efficiently and as effectively as possible. So that is by definition the process of capitalism, right? Like, is you take your capital and you use it as efficiently, as effectively as possible. That's just fucking normal. Like, right, you know, that's not a political thing. It's nothing fancy. It's just like all living things are performing this natural process of capitalism.
Thinking about a squirrel and like him collecting all the food for the winter. It's basically
seriously
that.
He's doing capitalism, right? So that's like the process of capitalism, right? Doing stuff with capital. Then you have the political thing, right? And the political, like, you know, if we know that capitalism as a process works, using things and stuff, energy, resources, time as efficiently and effectively as possible, then it would make sense to build some sort of political model, you know, or political process or political format or structure or governance system, whatever you want to call it, that as closely as possible either emulates or enables that natural capitalist process to occur. And if you want to call that political system capitalism, sure, that's fine. You know, we can call it capitalism the process, capitalism the politics, right? that's fine. You know, I don't think we can ever build a political model that is purely capitalistic as close as possible to the process, right? Because by, you know, when you build a, you know, a social process, you by definition have a layer on it. It's kind of like the map and the territory, right? The map will never 100% represent the territory, but it can get close. So what you want to do from a political governance standpoint is you want to build something that as closely as possible resembles the capitalistic process. And, you know, Bitcoin goes a long way to this. And let's tie it back to what we discussed earlier, is Bitcoin is the realest money because you can't reverse it. You can't, you know, so it localizes economic consequence. So therefore, you have a system where you are fundamentally incentivized to use your capital, Bitcoin, as efficiently and effectively as possible. So so it kind of that ties everything
That's a good loop,
together.
And also to earn it or play a part of allocating that capital, you are incentivized to not be a tourist, right? As a lot of people are tourists in jobs or, you know, stuff like that. So you have to add value to create value, to capture value, or something like that, right? Like you, it's forced. It's a forced incentive in a sense.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So how do you see, if we combine these things, like on communists, we're talking about energy, like how do you see the future for Bitcoin and the application in the world?
I mean, it's very bright. Like it's going to continue on. Like I wrote in fact, I'll see if I can find a passage here quickly that I was writing a section for the Bushido of Bitcoin, which kind of just basically summarizes why people should have Bitcoin. So I'll just read it. I said, all that being said, don't be stupid. Betting against Bitcoin is quite possibly the dumbest social and economic decision you could possibly make. Doubly so if you have agreed with the rest of this book and want to work towards A, making the world a better, more beautiful, ascended place, and B, if you want to have a lineage that lives on to benefit from that world. Ignoring it is not far behind. So if you do not hold Bitcoin, and when I say hold, I mean actually hold it, not some ETF or instrument, you should change that now. So like, you know, my message there is basically like, you know, don't be stupid, quit ignoring it. You know, Bitcoin's going to continue to grow. It's not just a technology that, you know, these MySpace idiots say, it's like, oh yeah, Bitcoin's all technology. No, Bitcoin is a socioeconomic phenomenon. It's all of these things combined. Like creating a new money takes centuries, naturally speaking. And so Bitcoin's going to compress that in a short period of time. And, you know, if you're sleeping
because
on it.
Because it's technology, basically.
Well, because we live in a digital and technological world, and because it interfaces so well with that, right? And, you know, that just means it's going to grow at a much faster rate because it's not a physical object, but it has a relationship to the physical world through energy. So it's like this beautiful, like elegant blend of all of these things. And to sort of sum up that line of thought and to finish this up, it's, you know, sleeping on Bitcoin and ignoring it or betting against it, they're all just dumb decisions. So don't be stupid. Get some Bitcoin, learn about it, and, you know, make your life better.
I heard American Hodl, there was a video of him where he talks about, you know, adopting Bitcoin is self-love, right? And basically what you
really
just
is.
Said, like, if you ignore it, you basically hate yourself. And it's so funny when I hear myself say these things, right? Like if I think about like 5 years ago, I was already into Bitcoin and never thought like, oh, these are really things I'm going to say and believe. But like I'm there, you know, like it's so funny. But I think that's what Bitcoin makes you do. Like once you see it, it's really, you cannot unsee it, and you are also, you feel incentivized, I think that's the best, that's a good word, to also do the contribution, right? Like that's why I started the podcast, that's why you're writing. It's a mutually beneficial game instead of a zero sum exercise with, you know, some rando people that you don't even like. You know, it's way more than technology. I love that you said that.
Yeah,
awesome, man. Well, then I'd love to wrap up with my last question that I ask everyone. And that's, what's a core belief that you will never let go? I know.
No, because I have many. That's why.
All right.
I think Let's just pepper this one in. I think the opposite to communism is beauty. And I think this is poorly understood, but beauty is ascendant. Beauty is the ultimate low time preference pursuit. It takes time, effort, energy, sacrifice, courage, duty, loyalty, respect, justice, all of these, all of the greatest virtues combined, are required in order to build, produce, create something beautiful. And I think it's the highest pursuit. It's right up there with, the concept of, the ineffable or God, right? Like, so beauty for me is the opposite of communism, because communism represents everything that is ugly, everything that is death, dying, and decaying. So yeah, I encourage people to think deeply about that one, because, most people tell you the opposite of communism is capitalism, which, it is. But, fundamentally speaking, the thing that the thread that runs through that is beauty.
Yeah. Love that, man. I think that's a great ender. I'll make sure to link to your social, your website. We didn't even talk about Spirit of Satoshi, maybe next time, but I think that's a very, very cool experiment. So we definitely encourage people to check that out. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on, man.
Thank you, my friend. Really appreciate it.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.